Hey everybody, this is another episode of the Welcome To podcast. I'm your host, Zach Vega. Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. We're a nonprofit based out of beautiful Traverse City, Michigan, specializing in projects that help communities to improve on their sustainability, and we've been working around the state since 1993. If you want to follow the Welcome To podcast, follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or however you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to check us out at liaa.org. Today's episode is with Dr. Noah Durst. Noah is a researcher and professor at the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at Michigan State University. His research primarily focuses on informal housing in Texas colonias. He's done a lot of work on that, but he's also looked at other areas, and the research that he's done really applies to a wide range of places as housing affordability becomes more scarce as more places are heavily developed. And Noah really looks at how low-income people are finding housing in an increasingly unaffordable market and the actual steps that they're using and the methods that they're using to do so. So thanks to Noah for joining me today, and I hope you guys enjoy the episode. Thanks.
Sounds good.
So to preface this conversation, Noah was my professor and my guide through helping me muddle through all of my fun thesis work. He's a data guy who specializes in housing. So if you want to give a little background on your research and how you ended up at MSU, what your research focuses on, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. I'd be happy to. Thanks for having me come in. Actually, thanks for coming to me. Good to see you again. So my research focuses on a variety of topics. One big component has to do with housing. A lot of my focus historically has been on housing outside of cities, so housing on the urban fringe. A lot of that has been in Texas, and that is really inspired by my experience living in South Texas as a teacher right out of college. And I got a job with Teacher America in 2004, moved to South Texas and started teaching, and was I was struck by housing conditions there. It's a very low income part of the country, and there are a lot of housing challenges, a lot of people in need of affordable housing, and not much being produced formally by the formal market. And so a lot of families find their way into an affordable, safe housing situation through their own means, through their own physical labor and their own sacrifice. And I was struck by that as a teacher. I remember having students come into the classroom and talking with them about their home and their neighborhood. And I remember cases where students could not complete homework because they didn't have working electricity. And I just remember being struck by that. And I ended up 6 or 7 years later deciding to go back to school for a master's degree to get a better understanding of poverty in our country and in the Western Hemisphere, really, and ended up serendipitously just meeting a professor who had been doing housing-related research in my old town that I had lived in Rio Grande City in South Texas. And I got lucky enough to work with him, this professor, Peter Ward, at the LBJ School, UT Austin, on a really interesting research project looking at an effort to provide clean property title to homeowners. And it was in the community I had lived in before. In the process of doing research for that project, I ran into some of my old students. Sometimes in the process of knocking on a door to interview a family, I would see a student that I had taught in middle school. And that was my first time studying housing. It ended up being the beginning of a series of 7 or 8 studies on South Texas or on housing conditions that and neighborhoods that follow a similar trajectory. And so a lot of the work I've done has been centered around very low-income housing in the country, mostly Texas, but more recently I've been looking at similar patterns of housing production across the country outside of the Texas-Mexico border region. And really I've been trying to My main objective in regards to housing research has been to get a deeper understanding of how families make ends meet in regard to housing when they are not granted assistance from state or federal or local governments for housing. So for the 70% of households who, given their income, are eligible for housing but don't receive any eligible for housing assistance but don't receive any assistance, I'm interested in how those families make ends meet. And so I've spent a good deal of time in investigating that, the various pathways that they take.
Right, and it is, so I guess we can start that off. I worked on a literature review with you on how low-income people essentially priced out of the housing market acquire housing, because it's something that people are thinking more about now as we sort of have a housing crisis right now, as a lot more people are priced out than before. And at the MAP conference, one of the speakers was talking about how it's sort of like a lottery system for what we used to call Section 8, the housing vouchers, that of the people who are eligible to go after that voucher, I think it's like 1 out of 5 actually get it, and then it's sort of a weird placement system of where you can live, what houses you can live in. So a lot of people, for those obvious reasons, sort of use different means to find housing. So can you go through how people are doing that?
Outside of the subsidized housing system?
Well, I guess we can start with the subsidized housing system and kind of what's going on with that currently.
Sure. I will do my best to summarize what I know, but not cite specific statistics because I don't want to get them terribly wrong. But 1 out of 5 sounds about right in terms of a lottery for a voucher. So we don't have any entitlement housing programs that I'm aware of, which would mean that everyone who meets a certain income threshold, either below the poverty line or below median income in their region, even if a family is eligible or a household is eligible, given their income, there simply might not be enough funding to provide every household who needs that assistance. And so some families, some households are lucky enough to get a voucher, which would allow them, once you receive a voucher, you can use it to go to a private landlord and rent that unit. And the voucher would cover the difference between your income that you can afford and the cost of the unit itself. So the voucher travels with the tenant, and the tenant can take it to a different unit, a different housing unit, to use it. There are other federal and state subsidies that subsidize the building of affordable housing itself, would actually invest in the construction of the building, and that building would be operated by a housing authority, for example, who would run the building and then would allow low-income eligible households, persons, to live there. And then there are developer subsidies, the low-income housing tax credit program, LIHTC, for example, the largest one, that provides a subsidy to a private developer who then agrees to rent, lease apartments to income-eligible households for a certain period of time. And so that's a brief description of 3 major approaches to providing housing, government-subsidized housing. But you sum up all of those various programs, the many billions invested, and we serve, all of those programs combined, serve only a fraction of the households that actually need assistance. And so it's, you know, there are millions of families who fall through the cracks in that system. And I've personally not actually done any research myself on any of those large federal-funded housing policy programs. There's a lot of good research out there on their effectiveness, and you know, important things to highlight is the role that housing assistance plays in providing stability for a family, particularly for children, but for adults as well. The importance of being able to move to a higher opportunity neighborhood and the impact it has on children in the long term, their educational outcomes, their eventual occupational outcomes, you know, their employment outcomes, are dramatic and very important. The truth is, though, we simply don't provide enough funding to offer that opportunity to every household. And so some households need to find other means to find accessible, affordable, safe housing.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the voucher program and the ability to choose where you're living with the government assistance, that's sort of a response to, it's the post-large development public housing units that we're sort of used to seeing,
where poverty was really concentrated, and that it clearly had a lot of detrimental social and economic effects on the people who lived there. So the idea was give people a voucher to go find their own housing from, typically, isn't it a list of units that they're able to rent from?
I don't want to misspeak on any of this. I'll give my best brief description that I can. You can fact check me after the fact if you need to. There was a strong, vehement movement against housing projects or directly subsidized housing construction and management by government. So the building of housing projects and their operation and management by governments. And if I recall correctly, that argument against it was in part due to siting issues, that many projects were built in siting and design issues, built in places and in ways that simply were not amenable to strong communities, not amenable to safe environments, you know, building large towers where there's no sense of community. It's a concrete structure with no good areas for play and recreation and whatnot. So I think there was a movement against government subsidized affordable housing construction via projects. I'm honestly not an expert on that history, though I've read it. I'm not an expert on it.
I did one of these with MSU Extension yesterday, and we prefaced everything with, "I'm not a lawyer." With your lawyer. It's okay if we're not getting, if we haven't read every inch of the literature.
Good. Okay. Because I haven't.
I think you know it well enough. You know it more than most. So that's okay.
So yes, I think part of the reaction against that was siting and design issues. And I think part of it is, historical long-term disinvestment in those housing units. You know, the failure to continue to upgrade them led to deterioration of them, and led to poor housing quality, poor building quality
in places of low opportunity.
So in places of low opportunity,
bad siting, bad design,
and they were often built in places that resegregated, built in areas that resegregated communities or entrenched segregation, racial or income. And so there's justifiable critiques of the way that public housing projects were undertaken. That doesn't mean that there isn't still a need for fully government subsidized and constructed housing. You know, vouchers appear to work well, particularly if you can ensure that voucher holders move to high opportunity neighborhoods. And there, it's important to have an element of choice to allow families to have flexibility to choose where they want to live. And that's a benefit of vouchers over a project. There's an argument for investment by private developers via programs like LIHTC, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, an efficiency argument that doing so incentivizes the private market to provide more housing units than you would get if government was footing the entire bill. And that seems like a valid argument to me as well, but that doesn't change the fact that there are some extremely low-income families who need full subsidies. Or to put it a different way, LIHTC can't subsidize the production of housing units that are affordable for the very, very low income households. It works for moderate to low income households, but not the poorest of the poor in our country. So we really do need a mix of housing subsidy approaches. Each one achieves a particular part of a goal, but not the entirety of it.
Right. And so for the time being, while we're figuring out how to, I guess the hope would be that eventually it's similar to other programs that we have in the country, that we have, I guess you would call it an entitlement program for if you're below this threshold, then there is housing for you still. You don't have to worry about where you're going to sleep or where your kids are going to sleep. So, but for the time being, while we're figuring that out, how are people housing themselves, or how are they getting around this?
Those who are not lucky enough to receive a subsidy,
right,
or benefit from a subsidy. So that's actually been the focus of my research. So I can talk about that with much more accuracy and confidence. There's a few approaches. The most easy to understand would be overcrowding or doubling up, living with family. I haven't done any research on that directly, but that's a pretty intuitive response, particularly in the event of in the case of these critical events that happen in people's lives, loss of employment or an issue with health or something, families are, to the extent that they have extended family around, are likely to move in with their extended family. And they could double up in a housing unit and live in somewhat overcrowded conditions, but increasing.
Do you know what we typically consider to be overcrowded?
Oh, I don't. There are a variety.
I remember from one, literature, there's like a variety of ratios that they consider, but it's
it's people per bedroom,
right?
And people per bedroom has gone down over time historically as homes have gotten larger in this country, and there have been more bedrooms and smaller families. That metric of overcrowding has gone down, but I don't know if there's a standard approach. You know, is it two people per bedroom or one per bedroom?
Yeah, and I remember from the literature there were other measures as well. I think there were like three or four ways of looking at it. One was square footage, people per number, a certain number of square feet, and then at the bedroom. But yeah, there was a variety of ways of looking at that. But needless to say, I think if you went into an apartment, it would be pretty easy to see if it was overcrowded or not.
Yeah, I think, and it, honestly, a lot of that varies by, if you measure by square foot, it varies by your location in a metro area. Well, you know, if you're in a rural area, on average, you would have much more space within your house than you would in New York City, in Manhattan, mm-hmm. you know. And I think for that reason, overcrowding is a difficult metric to use because it varies across the life course. You know, if you have children in the household or if you're elderly and your children have moved out, it varies so much, it's hard to use that as an objective metric of the burden. But that doesn't change the fact that families do, in response to financial need or critical economic or health-related events, choose or need to double up. But I have focused more closely on the way in which families double up in relation to their housing unit itself. So a lot of what the recent research is showing is that in many metro areas across the country, and especially the metro areas with the tightest housing markets, with limited supply and substantial demand, what is happening is households, homeowners are deciding to build a second house in the back of their lot, or they're choosing to expand their housing unit and partition it, split it in half, or they're choosing to convert their garage into a residential unit. And then extended family are moving into these. These are like granny flats, garage conversions that grandma and grandpa might move into, either when they decide they want to downsize or just to make space for an extended family. And that's I would say it's shockingly common. I don't think it's particularly common in Michigan, simply because there isn't that demand pressure like there are in coastal cities. But my guess would be that in Michigan cities with substantial demand for housing and not enough supply, it's happening there as well. It's probably under the radar. Or in college towns like East Lansing, my guess is there's some informal splitting, partitioning of housing units, you know, putting up a divider in a housing unit and making it two units instead of one and then renting it out. I would guess that's pretty common here as well. But really fascinating research in Los Angeles, other cities in California, doing project now in Salt Lake City, finding fairly widespread instances of housing units being put to uses that they are not legally permitted to be used as. You know, a garage conversion, basement conversion. And I think I feel pretty confident saying that is a very widespread phenomenon. I can't put specific numbers on it, at least not nationally, but I think it's very, very common, and it's driven in part by need, by families knowing that they have relatives or friends who need a place to stay, and it's an easy solution, albeit one that's not permitted by local government.
Right, and if people are wondering, well, why isn't it permitted, or why is that not okay, what are the issues with that happening? I know one of them, when I was going through this, was I think there was an example in New York, like if there's a fire in the building and they have a layout or a map or a blueprint of the building for the firefighter's safety, it's very dangerous if they're going into an apartment building and they go in and the floor plan is different from what they were expecting because there's a bunch of added walls and partitions. It poses a big threat to emergency responders. But are there any other issues that come along with that?
Yeah, I think there's
I'm sure there's health issues.
There's a lot. But I think the most important risk associated with that type of informal housing conversion or housing development, I would call it informal. It's going against or it's circumventing existing regulations. The health risks are the big, really important ones. So you mentioned emergency personnel being able to get into the house. There's also residents themselves being able to get out in the event of an emergency, like a fire. Means of egress is a big one. So I actually don't know the code on this, but I would assume that houses are supposed to have two means of egress in case one is blocked by a fire. And splitting a house in half, partitioning it in the middle, and making the back door the entry for one part and the front door the entry for the other means you've now lost those two means of egress. So that's a huge issue. But there's a host of issues that I think would arise. Just things like air quality of the construction itself, whether it exposes the housing unit to something like rain or the weather. I mean, a lot of these improvements or modifications to the home are actually being done by the homeowner themselves, not a contractor. The contractor is beholden, is aware of the rules and beholden to the permitting process. Their license is contingent upon that. A homeowner who's doing any remodeling themselves might be less aware or less concerned about the potential professional risks. So there's that. Depending on how the unit is constructed, especially if it's a garage conversion or a back house, there's a question of whether those units are being connected to something like sewer and piped water and electrical. Are they running an electrical cord from the main house to the back house? If so, that is very risky and a fire hazard. Is there a heating system installed? Are they using a space heater? Is there water and wastewater installed? Is there, you know, what's happening with wastewater? And I know that there are some cases. Jake Wegman from UT Austin has done some really fascinating work. In Los Angeles, did a series of case studies and analyses of this type of development in LA, and found cases where there was an RV that was parked in the driveway that was used as the bathroom because the garage didn't have a bathroom. And just a host of problems there that are health related, and I'd say they're the most serious. But there's a range of implications for neighbors, for the city government as a whole, its ability to plan for and manage housing development, but to garner taxes, also those sorts of things are put in jeopardy by unpermitted development. You know, there's questions about what happens with the property when it's sold. If it is, you know, you have a back house that's completely unpermitted. Some cities have laws that say before it can sell, it needs to be brought fully up to code. It could be a $20,000 investment to bring it up to code. Now, if it's just a garage conversion, and you rip out insulation in the garage and, you know, redo a few things and take out any water or disconnect water and electricity and the garage is back to normal, might only cost a couple grand to do that re-renovation, to bring it back into code. But if you've built an entire second unit, an accessory dwelling unit or a granny flat, the homeowner could be out thousands for that, or tens of thousands.
Right. And I remember you showing us pictures of how that occurs, and it's always a question of, well, how can that happen under the watch of the local government? But really, you can't enforce things unless you can see them from the road. So enforcement is difficult to do unless, you know, you're getting complaints or something like that. But typically, would you say that these types of informal developments happen in a clustered way, where it's a whole neighborhood that, you know, it's a similar socioeconomic status that's allowing this to happen? It's usually not just one neighbor.
I don't know. For the latter question, I don't know. It's certainly true that it's hidden. You know, we have robust protection for property rights in this country, and code enforcement can't enter someone's property just to see if there's something unpermitted back there. They'd have to see it and know it was, they'd have to see it from the road and know it was unpermitted. And so if it's a back house and you have a fence up, unless your neighbors complain, code enforcement might never know. And again, Jake, there are only a few people doing work on this topic. So if I reference people, it's because they're doing very interesting work. But again, it's, you know, some of Jake Wegman's work on code enforcement suggests that, you know, the vast majority of the cases that are being identified are through complaints by neighbors. And so the real question is, like, what type of development can occur without raising a red flag to neighbors? And I guess it's a tenant that's respectful, a big issue that seems to come up, at least in very dense neighborhoods with lots of informal units, is parking. If you have three housing units on one lot, you could have six cars there needing parking space. So I think the parking issue becomes pretty controversial. But it flies under the to your early question. It flies under the radar because it's hidden from view, and it's in part hidden from view because at least the way informal housing exists in this country is it is interwoven with a formal market. There are informal units that have been developed on parcels or lots that are otherwise fully permitted, compliant with the zoning code, the house built to comply with the building code. It's just the back house that's non-compliant. It's everything but the back house, or everything but the garage conversion. And so it's just difficult to spot. And there are certainly, I don't want to underplay the severity of the health and safety risks, because there are certainly many housing units that are built informally and that pose a severe health and safety risk. But not all of them do. I've been in informally built additions to homes that you could not tell was unpermitted. You would only know by looking in city records to see if it were permitted or not. And so by sight alone, it's really hard to tell sometimes. But the numbers are pretty shocking. I mean, Jake Wegman, again, in California, he did a study with Sarah Malhorter from, who is at Berkeley, and they estimated like on the average city in California, one in four new housing units is unpermitted. That's
wow.
One out of four. That's pretty shocking. Yeah. I mean, it's a big number. It's not, it's almost one in two in the densest cities. So where there's lots of people who need housing, you know, lots of people living in close proximity. It's almost every other house that is built is unpermitted. That's pretty shocking. I mean, it's shocking enough that it's hard to square with what we think about the institution of planning and what planners do and what their role is in society in our country. I think people who study the developing world are much more comfortable acknowledging that planning has limits to its reach. Regardless of what planners want to do in the world, there is a limit to which they might in reality, at least given our current tools and resources and what have you, there's a limit to what we really can do. And I think the one in two estimates in some of these dense California cities kind of make it a stark reality.
Right. It's the kind of thing where maybe it's going to take us 5 to 10 years to figure out this issue and how to deal with this housing crisis, but people don't have 5 to 10 years to figure out their own housing situation. They have to figure it out today. So you can really understand why people are going to the lengths. And I imagine in Michigan, this would be fairly common, maybe not fairly common. I don't want to suggest that we don't even really know if it's happening at all in Michigan, but I would imagine it's possibly happening in, you know, like I live in Traverse City or, you know, resort towns that rely on a large employment base of service industry employees who come in for the summer and don't get paid very high wages, but they have to pay for really expensive housing while they're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rent in Traverse City is really high right now, and they have a ton of service industry people. So I imagine issues like overcrowding are popping up, you know, and we don't have that supported by any data, but I imagine we think about it happening in Los Angeles and New York, but it probably is happening in our backyard too.
I think so, especially in, I think it's, if it is happening anywhere in the city or in the state, it's happening in those markets where we know there's demand, where there's a lot of jobs and there's need for new housing and the housing isn't coming online quick enough. So I would think Grand Rapids, Ann Arbor, possibly Traverse City. Yeah, I don't have any evidence to support that, but that would be where I would look first. You know, when I moved here from Texas, I was actually struck by the connections between Texas and Michigan. And one of those connections that I remember when I first got here was the South Texas-Michigan relationship via migrant labor. You know, there are many migrant laborers who are moving from Texas to Michigan to work in fields and then back. And in fact, the communities that I had spent a lot of time studying in Texas are predominantly migrant labor communities. And so I can remember being a teacher and having many, many students who would be gone for part of the year and would come back. And when I asked them where they were, they'd say Michigan. So I think, at this point, it might be helpful for me to introduce a different idea of how to think about informal housing. It requires a little bit of conceptual flexibility, but if you'll permit me, the work I started doing on this topic of housing was also in places where informal housing was very common, but it wasn't housing necessarily that was non-compliant with land use regulations. So it wasn't non-compliant with zoning ordinances. It wasn't non-compliant with subdivision regulations or building codes. It simply existed in places where those regulations did not exist. And that's a bit of a peculiarity for Michigan. Michigan and Texas have very different approaches to governance and land use, in part driven by the fact that there are townships here and not in Texas. In Texas, outside of a city, you're in a county territory. And historically, counties in Texas have had almost no ability to regulate land use. They still lack zoning, so they can't divide land up and say, this is for single-family housing, and that's for commercial development, and that's industrial. They just don't have that authority constitutionally. They are not home rule entities. Counties are not in Texas. And they still can't enforce building codes. That's not quite accurate. There are many, until about 4 years ago, they couldn't enforce building codes at all. And now they can, but there are so many exemptions that most people are completely exempt. And then subdivision regulations, which govern how, when you purchase land and then divide it up to sell it, for example, to make a neighborhood, a subdivision, there are rules that tell you, like, you got to install water and wastewater, and you've got to install electricity and these other things. You have to create a map, a plat, showing who, you know, what each lot is named. And so when you sell it, it can be tracked in the property system. Well, prior to 1990, Texas counties couldn't do that. So for three decades, thousands of low-income neighborhoods were developed by developers, or thousands of neighborhoods were developed and sold to very low-income families. Lots were sold, pieces of land were sold without water, without infrastructure of any sort, often with promises that the infrastructure would be installed later, and families bought it and started building the homes themselves. And those are the communities that I first started studying. My first interest in understanding housing and poverty was studying these neighborhoods called colonias in South Texas. And those neighborhoods are informal, not because they are, I would refer to them as an informal subdivision, not because they're violating any rule, but simply because they're not subject to the land use regulations that across the vast majority of this country, neighborhoods are subject to. I would guess that many, the conditions that you see in those neighborhoods early on, when families are just making ends meet and acquiring a dilapidated trailer that they put on a lot that they live in cramped conditions, I would guess that they're fairly similar to what a lot of farm laborers experience living on the farm when they're provided housing by their employer. So I would think if you looked in rural areas and you looked at places where there's a lot of agricultural labor, you would also see housing conditions and housing arrangements that are exposing residents to poor quality housing and safety risks. I don't know how in Michigan those living arrangements would be regulated, whether the land would actually be zoned agricultural, and then there could be more flexibility about how housing is regulated. But by any standard that we would deem appropriate for or adequate for housing in our country, conditions in colonias in Texas are often far below that standard. And I would venture to say for farm laborers as well. Inadequate space, so overcrowding, inadequate water quality and service, and I'd say that's fairly common. This is a little bit of a transition, but I want to at least mention it. Mobile home parks.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask about that. I was going to ask about those and contract for deed. Those were the two more that I was really interested in. And I'm hoping I'm not forgetting. I think there were like eight that we looked at. I'm trying to remember.
Eight different topics, yeah.
Something like that. But the two that I found, there was a lot of informal differences in informal housing. I think you covered a few of them when you were talking about that. But yeah, the mobile home parks was really interesting to me. Going through the literature, it seems to me to be the most effective way of solving the housing crisis in the short term, as long as you effectively regulate, because you can regulate the design standards of the mobile homes so they essentially just look like homes and they're high quality and they're much cheaper for people. But what are the issues that come up with that?
Well, you know, let me see, before I dive into it, let me like step back and remind our listeners that you know, my interest more broadly is in how families make ends meet. So I talked about informal conditions like in LA where you've got unpermitted units being developed, and that I talked about all the challenges, but what I didn't mention about that is it provides an additional supply of housing.
Right.
Maybe 25% more housing than you would have otherwise. The formal market is simply not supplying. And additional supply reduces costs, but it also, in the aggregate, it reduces costs on average, but it also supplies housing for those thousands of families who occupy it. The same in the cases of South Texas I was talking about. A lot of the families, well, self-build is the other issue that we didn't talk about.
So maybe
I hit self-build first and go to the other ones. I didn't describe this. A lot of the way in which families who buy neighborhood in a colonia in South Texas, the way they acquire housing is by first starting with a trailer, a used trailer, a mobile home, manufactured home. They all refer to the same type of housing. Starting with that and living in it for 5 to 10 years while they build their home, typically themselves, through their own labor, so self-help housing. That has benefit, again, it has benefits and disadvantages, just like the informality component. This self-help component or approach to providing housing in the absence of government subsidies comes with advantages and disadvantages. An advantage, one, is flexibility. Households can build and modify the homes as they see fit and need.
And it spreads the cost over time too, right?
Yeah, reduces cost dramatically. I mean, it reduces cost in two ways. One, labor is subsidized by the homeowner themselves or their friends, whoever assists. So you reduce labor cost. You still have material cost. But it spreads that cost over time in the same way that an amortized mortgage does. You know, an amortized mortgage takes the entire amount borrowed, adds interest, and spreads that out across a 30 or 15-year time period. Well, self-help allows for the same flexibility, reduced cost by building incrementally over time. And I have really good research from South Texas, one county in South Texas, showing that it takes about 2 decades for a household to finish, for a family to finish building their home. You can see very clearly that it isn't until about 20 years after families have purchased the property that their houses stop getting larger. Every year you look at the data, houses get larger until about 20 years, and then they stop getting larger because families have stopped building out. That incremental development process comes with risks, particularly in the early years. It comes with risks of overcrowding or just living in poor quality housing. And I think it comes with risks at the back end as families, as homeowners age, because if you've built the house yourself, as you age, you're less and less capable of continuing to modify it. So I think, you know, there are long-term issues to think about. But so that covers two of the approaches. Informal development, either non-compliant like in LA, or just unregulated as in Texas colonias, and then self-help. Manufactured homes or mobile homes is another key area of interest for me that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I started getting interested in it just because I noticed that in these informal subdivisions or colonias, mobile homes are very common early on, like 1 out of 2 or 40% of homeowners start with a mobile home. It typically is a 40-year-old mobile home, 30 or 40 years old. But then over time, after a decade or two, after these neighborhoods have formed, 2 decades later, mobile homes are only about 10% of housing units because families have replaced them with a site-built home, typically a self-built site-built home. So I have a paper that just came out this year with Esther Sullivan at CU Denver, and we looked nationally at mobile home ownership and renting and tried to identify, okay, what of the 10 million mobile homes in the nation, where are they located? Are they located in informal subdivisions like colonias, or are they located in mobile home parks? And it's probably good here to talk conceptually about what the difference is. A mobile home park is a commercial property that's owned by a landlord who rents space out to a to tenants who get to place a mobile home on the property. And typically that mobile home is owned by the resident, owned by the person who lives in it, but they lease the land underneath it. For a, you know, a smaller fraction of mobile home park residents, they actually rent both the mobile home and the land. But many, many, many people rent the land but own the house. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly split nationally. There are more mobile home park residents than there are residents in informal subdivisions. Or I should say that, to be precise, I should say that of the people who live in manufactured homes, more of them live in mobile home parks than informal subdivisions like colonias. Mm-hmm. I actually think there are more people living in informal subdivisions like colonias across the country, but it's hard to measure that because they have replaced their mobile home with a site-built home, and it's hard to track those in the data that I use. So anyway, that's like the third area of interest is mobile home parks, and they...
And typically those come with a stigma, so they get zoned in really in places without access to amenities, good public transportation, schools. They're in the least desirable place of the community typically.
Yep, they're zoned out.
Right, because there's typically a requirement that you have to allow that use within the municipality, but then communities take that and they go, okay, let's put it in this area where it has little impact on what we would consider. They put it where they want to put it, not where it should be.
Yeah, they're typically not located in high amenity areas. Mobile home parks are not located necessarily in high opportunity areas. You know, it probably varies by state law. I do know of cities, and I've read about cities and looked at data on cities that completely prohibit them. So it is possible for cities in some states, at least, to completely prohibit mobile home parks altogether. But state by state, some states might make it a requirement that cities host them somewhere, but then they're always put possibly in low opportunity areas. But that's one element, you know. And the research Esther and I did together, Esther Sullivan and I did, shows high degrees of segregation of housing type segregation for manufactured homes. So manufactured homes are almost always placed near each other, either in an informal subdivision, because lots of people rely on them, or in a mobile home park. But it's very rare to find a mobile home that's just located near other site-built dwellings. Right. So they are clearly zoned out, and there's good research showing that, you know, these prohibitions, zoning ordinances that prohibit them, reduce the people's ability to actually put a house on a lot or put it in a mobile home park. So that's one challenge with them that there's pretty good evidence on. Other challenges entail, and relatedly, that if they are located in low amenity areas, they are also disproportionately exposed to environmental burdens, either traffic risk and contaminated air quality or flooding risk or water quality risks. Recent research in California showing that mobile home parks are much more likely to have unreliable or poor quality water. So there's those issues make them... It's hard to say that mobile home parks are informal in the non-compliant respect. They're not necessarily non-compliant in the way that housing back houses in LA are, but they are... The regulatory approach to them consistently makes them a more vulnerable housing choice option. And I think there's an element of informality there. There's, if you are willing to use the word informal flexibly, and I am. But there are other risks. Esther's done some really fascinating work on, the title of her book is Manufactured Insecurity. And just looking at what happens to families when a mobile home park closes. You know, when you reside in a mobile home park, you might own your housing unit, but the landlord owns the land, and so you're at risk of development pressure. If the neighborhood that you reside in is ripe for redevelopment, is gentrifying, the landlord has an incentive to sell, and then you lose the site on which your house is located. And although they're called mobile homes, they're very costly to move. It's not cheap to have someone disconnected, relocate it, and then set up site somewhere else. So it comes with considerable risk. So I think the tenure insecurity issue is an important one. And Esther and I conclude this paper that we wrote last year about this comparison of informal subdivisions and mobile home parks. And we looked at things like affordability. We looked at a variety of different conditions, water quality, satisfaction among residents and owners and other things. But one of the most striking things is just differences in affordability, that we do think of mobile homes as being affordable, but they're dramatically more affordable when you own the land and the housing. They're less affordable when you only own the housing. And they're even less affordable when you don't own either. So affordability in part comes from...
how much money you have up front, right?
Well, it comes from the fact that there are benefits to being a homeowner in general that come with the building of... it's the principal rather than the equity that you build over time. And to the extent that you're capable of paying off the interest on any loan, you then have fewer payments to make, or you have lower payments to make. And so landowners who place a mobile home on it just have much lower costs. They're paying taxes and upkeep. They're not paying rent to a landlord continually. And so I think that drives the difference in profit. So what do you do about that? Esther and I conclude that paper by saying, look, the easiest, lowest-hanging fruit is to convert mobile home parks to owner-occupied subdivisions. And how do we do that? Well, we need a funding mechanism to actually buy them, and then we need tenants to have a stake in ownership, and they eventually would pay off the whatever loan is needed to purchase the entire property, and then they would be homeowners in place in a mobile home. We would be converting a mobile home park to an informal subdivision. There's still risks associated with that. Risks associated living in possibly a deteriorated mobile home, but it's far better than having your 10-year security hang on the whims of a landlord and the whims of redevelopment activity in your city. You know, I think it's important to keep, in my mind, it's important to keep mobile home parks in consideration, because mobile homes are the largest supply of affordable housing in this country, and there's just too little research on how well they work as a measure of affordability. Our research suggests they work best when there's a ownership stake in the land and the house, and I think policy should promote that. Whether these units are formal or informal, that's less important. It's unsubsidized, which is the key element of my research interest. What didn't we get to yet? Land contracts?
Contract for deed, land contracts.
So a relevant question, I guess, is how, when I was talking about colonias and these informal subdivisions, how is it that families buy property in a subdivision that's developed with minimal infrastructure, you know, without a house? You know, most people, when they think about buying a house from a developer, they're thinking about having bought the land and the house together. But in these informal subdivisions that I have studied, and I estimate there are at least a couple million housing units located in them, at a minimum. I would say 3 million housing units is a good guess. So we're talking about 10 million people living in them across the country. A lot of them, at least in Texas, bought through contract for deed. So contract for deed, also known as land contracts, also sometimes referred to as a poor man's mortgage, is essentially an agreement where you agree to buy property from me, but I will not give you the deed, the title, until you've completed all of your payments. And historically, at least, these contracts for deed or land contracts provided buyers with very little in the way of protection. So missing a single payment could lead the owner, me, to take the property away from you. You lose your entire investment. I retain the property, and I retain any structure you've built on the property. Texas had rampant use of these contracts for deed before 1995 or so. In some cases, developers were selling lots to more than one person, selling the same lot to more than one person. This is because they didn't enforce subdivision regulations, so developers were selling lots willy-nilly in some places. And Texas has since reformed their contract for deed to provide more protections, like if you've made a series of payments, I think it's 2 years, so 24 months or so, then you can't lose the equity that you've already invested. You know, if you've invested $10,000 in the purchase, you can't lose that. You are owed it back. Or you have a few months, you can't be foreclosed upon, or the property can't be repossessed until after a certain number of months of missed payments. But in general, and Heather Way from UT Austin, a lawyer from UT Austin, calls or refers to these contracts for deed as an informal means of home ownership, because it's a titling mechanism that provides much less security to the buyer. And land contracts exist here in Michigan.
I was talking to somebody that in Lansing that had one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. And I know I had read about, I don't know the specifics of this, but I know that after the Great Recession, there were some, I believe they were investment companies, I don't think they were developers, that were acquiring properties that had been foreclosed upon and then using land contracts, which function, they're not rent-to-own agreements. They're a distinct mechanism, but they function like rent-to-own agreements in some respects. And land contracts or contracts for deed there was an uptick in their use. And I believe I had seen research in Atlanta and Georgia saying the same thing. So it's a mechanism that provides the owner, the seller, more flexibility to repossess the property than a typical deed does. There's no need to go through the standard foreclosure process with a contract for deed. They often require very little down. In Texas, the ones that we had been examining years ago, that I'd examined with Peter Ward of the LBJ School, we saw interest rates that were 12, 13, 14% when the typical mortgage you would be getting would be 5%.
Right, and to clarify, if anyone is wondering why people would do that, these are mostly people who can't acquire a mortgage from a bank.
These are families who can't acquire a mortgage from a bank. They might not have the credit necessary,
right,
or the steady income,
right,
or what have you. But again, this is this is my interest. These are the families that need a subsidy. In South Texas, we're talking about families that are earning $17,000 a year, a family of five, and needing an affordable housing solution, and one doesn't exist. And there's a sense of optimism about owning property, having a house that's yours, an investment for your children. And I do want to note that over time, the asset that many families can build, many families living in a colonia, for example, in Texas, can build, is remarkable. I mean, go into many of these neighborhoods 40, 30 years after they started being developed, and many of the homes look like a middle class, 2,200 square foot, nicely manicured lawn, nice, wrought iron fence, stucco walls on the outside, beautifully painted, carport, not necessarily a garage, sometimes a garage, just really nice homes that you could see in pretty much any subdivision in South Texas, any formal subdivision. And many families make it's an incredible achievement to build your house yourself. But in the interim, the two things that concern me about that process, or two of the things of the many, is just the decades of sacrifice that have to happen to acquire a home of one's own, and the risk in the interim of repossession. Peter Ward from LBJ School and Carlos Olmedo, who was at the LBJ School before, had done some research in some of these communities where land contracts used to be very common, and because of state reforms in property law, they're no longer used. But developers found workarounds, and they found, I think they're using what are called deeds in lieu of foreclosure. I believe they have a series of clauses that make it easy for them to repossess the property. And Peter and Carlos had found that 50% of buyers were losing their investment within the first 2 years. So half of the people who buy a lot get repossessed on.
Wow.
And that's in part, I guess, driven by their incomes are low enough that they can't afford to maintain the payments. But again, my broader point is these are families that should have access to subsidized housing.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions of households in the country that need it and aren't getting it. And I guess the work I've been trying to do is to find out what happens to these families as they wait for some kind of government assistance. Look at those various paths.
All right, we're at about an hour, so I think that's really good. That's really good information. It's as soon as I came to MSU, I was really interested in the work you were doing because I think it's something that it's so common, but people don't think about it. The idea that if you can't participate in the formal housing market, you're going to find a workaround, and people are intelligent and innovative, and they're going to figure out a workaround. But there's hardly any data on it. There's very few people, like you said, working on it. It's like you and three other people. Mm-hmm. So thanks for doing the work and collecting the data and helping us to understand these issues and ultimately taking the time to talk about them so that we can figure out solutions to, I think, what's going to just continue to be a problem going forward as it's so expensive to develop housing right now, and there's not a lot of affordable housing in so many places that this is just going to continue to be an issue. So the more we understand it, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, if I can have 1 minute to just ramble again, that was hour went by quickly. Clearly I can ramble about my topic. We do have a severe affordable housing crisis. You know, I didn't note this, but there's not a, let me see if I get the statistic right. There's not a single county in the nation where a minimum wage employee can afford a 2-bedroom home. There's not a single county. And that is driven largely in coastal areas by exorbitant housing prices driven by lots of demand and limited supply. Land use regulation plays a key role there, and you know, cities don't want to develop dense housing, and it puts pressure on the broader housing market. It's also driven, though, by just stagnant wages, 40 years of no wage growth. Mm-hmm. Now, housing has continued to go up, and other costs have continued to go up. So it's a problem that's not going to be solved without major structural change. And like a lot of other scholars, I'm interested in exploring the ways that the impact of inequality, the impact of the divergence between housing costs and incomes. But I'm studying a series of housing conditions or housing situations, especially the informal ones, that are really hard to get data on. So you mentioned, like, I'm a data person, and like me and a couple other people are using creative ways to get data. It is that's the hardest part, is to get really good data to figure out how to describe the conditions and phenomena that I'm interested in, because by the fact that many of these phenomena are under the radar, not subsidized, not permitted, the things we want to study actually are often not tracked easily by the large databases that academics use to study society. So a lot of creativity goes into that, and I like the challenge of it. It seems like it's such an important issue. It seems like it's worth the challenge of trying to find out how to document what's going on in regard to housing today. And I hope, you know, I mentioned three people doing this work. There are five or six of us who've been doing it consistently for 5 years or more, and it seems like every couple months I see another article that's mentioning, like, we didn't talk about homelessness, but that's another element of sleeping on the street is in violation of code, and so we need, have a desperate need for research on things like homelessness, other ways in which people fill the gap that's left by 40 years, 35 years of disinvestment in housing. You know, since Reagan, we have failed to provide the subsidies for the people who need it. And it's just important we know what the long-term impact of that is.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk again, because I feel like we could go on another 3 hours about housing. But for today, we'll leave it there.
Good.
So thanks, Noah.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Thank you.
Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. For more information about what we do, go to liaa.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Talk to you guys next time.